Hello and welcome to Conker's Corner. Today I have the privilege of speaking with Martin Flitton. Martin is well known as a writer and on the Cambridge News website, and he's also known on Twitter as Private Punter. Martin is a well-regarded investor and has been writing for the Cambridge News for some time now. Good morning, Martin. How are you, chap?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you, Peter. And you?
I'm very good, thank you, mate. I've had a busy few days, but I'm so glad to have got you. I know you're a busy and well sought after individual. I'm just hoping today, Martin, that we don't get any more aftershocks from what's been going on recently in the news.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hopefully, during this interview, I won't, switch back onto Twitter and find that something else has imploded somewhere.
Okay. Well, look, thanks for the opportunity to come and talk to you, which I think is great, because I think the more we can get this out into the open, people talk in different views, I think it's great.
No, I absolutely agree with you. And thank you for sharing the time today, Martin. It's very kind of you to do that.
No, you're welcome.
Now, Martin, lots of people know of you. And Lots of people I see retweeting the articles from the Cambridge News site regarding companies that you've researched and you've shared your viewpoints on them. I just wondered if you could just take a little step back and just introduce yourself to those of our global audience that don't know of Martin Flitton, haven't read the Cambridge News articles that you've published, and obviously things that you've published on your website as well. Just who is Martin Flitton, Private Punter, etc. And if you could start with the journey from when you were a youngster as well, as to what first garnered an interest for you.
Okay, yeah. My early years, very unremarkable. Education-wise, I didn't achieve much apart from two O-levels, English language and lit. So I had a specific interest in that, in writing and reading.
Yep.
Nothing on the share side at that point. So on leaving school, I went into an apprenticeship, which is what we did in those days, back in the sort of mid-70s. So I embarked on a painting and decorating career, served my apprenticeship, and on completing that, very quickly went out and started up my own business. It was probably round about the early 90s that I sort of gained a real interest in shares and wanted to learn more. But I found that very hard to basically get hold of information, sort of access decent info apart from buying the FT or Investors Chronicle. So I set off to the library, the local library, and had a look around, and they actually ordered a number of books in for me, which sort of piqued my interest. And from then, what I did, I read and sort of watched and studied, and I sort of did dummy runs for about a year without actually making an investment.
Okay, that's interesting. Good.
Yeah. Just to see whether my feelings that I could make money over the longer term, whether that was something was feasible. So I concluded that it was. And it was round about the sort of mid-90s, early mid-90s, that we were renovating the house that we're living in now. I had a lot of work sort of undertaken. And at that point, we had a delivery from Ibstock, the brickmakers.
Yes, yep.
And ordinarily, we would receive it from our building suppliers, Ridgeons in Cambridge. But on this particular occasion, it came direct from Ibstock. And the guy turned up, and it was on a Saturday morning, which was unusual to get a delivery on a Saturday. And he turned up, so I made the guy a cup of coffee and asked him how he was going. And he was telling me that he'd been with Ibstock for 25 years, and having been through a really bad sort of recession in the early 90s, by this time, I think it was about 94, he sort of said to me, we're as busy as I've ever seen it.
Wow, okay.
I had already sort of looked at building companies because I thought if I was going to invest, I wanted to go with something that I felt comfortable with, that I got a grasp on things and had a handle on it. So I took a close look at Ibstock, and I think the shares off the top of my head were at the time about 31, 32p. So I took a leap and I bought Ibstock, and at the same time I bought Marley Roof Tiles, because I knew a fair bit about Marley. And both were subsequently taken over at premiums.
Excellent. So those were the first two stocks that you purchased?
They were the first two.
Excellent. Stocks. And that's the great thing about that, was what you touched on earlier, is that you were finding your way in the market and doing your research and doing dummy runs before you took the leap. Excellent.
Yeah, yeah. So from there, I sort of obviously became more involved, read more. And as you'll appreciate, and listeners will appreciate, it tends to become all-encompassing. You know, it really sort of pulls you in.
Yes, it does. Winning does sometimes, doesn't it? It feeds the adrenaline and the testosterone.
Yeah, well, we'll come to the losing as well.
Of course.
So from there, what happened? I'd got a group of friends who had bought into privatisation, sort of the gas, BT.
Yeah.
Thing. And we decided to form a share club, which consisted of about 10 of us, and we were doing quite well. And I don't know how it happened, but the Cambridge News was sort of doing various sort of features on clubs and things, and they contacted us and asked if we would have a chat about the share club and how we were doing and, you know, what we hoped to achieve. So the other guys elected me a spokesperson. So I was interviewed by the business editor, Jenny Chapman, and we got on really well. They ran a story. She then came back and asked me if I undertake a one-off column, just highlight a stock that I was looking at. And I said, yeah, give it a go. As I've already said, I had a sort of passion for writing. So I picked on a company called Parker Knoll, who, amazingly, I think within 12 months, they were taken out too.
Yeah, furniture manufacturers, weren't they?
That's right, yeah. Anyway, that one piece that I penned for them led to the news coming back and asking me if I'd be happy to do a monthly slot, which I said yes to, and that then increased to a weekly slot.
Excellent.
So it went from there, and it sort of evolved into going out and undertaking interviews, you know, on the Science Park, being located as I am just a couple of miles away from the Science Park, close to the city. It was ideal.
So how long have you been writing now for Cambridge Magazine?
For the Cambridge News.
Yeah,
16 years.
Wow, from just setting up the club to getting recognised.
Yeah, yeah.
Notorious for identifying takeovers. 16 years on.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Not so many lately, but there we go.
Yeah,
So that's, as I say, it sort of evolved. I write for the Cambridge Business Magazine as well, which is a slightly different format.
Yeah,
it's more, you know, focused on the business itself and the people, and how it sits in Cambridge as opposed to, you know, an investment case. But it's nice to do both things. And to be honest, you know, both things sort of interact. It serves well. As far as my own website goes, I set that up about 3 years ago, and it's run well up until last summer, when the company that sort of housed that for me outsourced a lot of the stuff, and the site was hacked. And it wasn't just my site, it was a number of the other customers as well.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And that happened again. So I called it a day, and I'm in the process of having a new one constructed. So hopefully that will sort of sit alongside what I do for the Cambridge News as well.
Okie dokie. So in essence then, you've been investing in shares since the mid-90s.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you first started, Martin, what was your criteria? You were doing your dummy runs and checking out and doing lots of reading. But when you first started in the mid-90s, what were you looking for? Okay. And what were your criteria for choosing those stocks and the dummy stocks before you did your first purchase, please?
Sure, yeah. I think, as I say, I tended to concentrate on construction-related companies because that was my background.
Yeah.
But as far as specifics go, fundamentally sound companies, so balance sheets were strong. They weren't overly geared. They were cash generative.
Yeah.
And they importantly were profitable with you know sort of end markets that weren't likely to disappear.
Yeah, tangible markets.
Or become under marked pressure. Of course, I'm aware that in talking about construction companies and the like, they're highly cyclical.
Highly cyclical. Yeah.
Yeah, and you have to balance that. But that was, you know, for me, they were the key points. And one thing that I quickly picked up on was you know, companies that were on a low PER, so on a single-digit price-earnings ratio. And often you could find companies that were on, a PER of six, but they were also sort of paying a dividend of around about 5% or 6%. That was in tandem with that, and I quickly sort of worked out that you know that anomaly often pointed to a company in distress. So you know, as in you know, profits were actually decreasing.
Yeah,
the dividend cover was very weak, and so what you're actually seeing there is a historic sort of point of where that they're at, as opposed to where they are in the future.
Yes.
So what I guess what I'm trying to say is that you know I, at that stage I was very very much aware that you know you could quickly sort of be of the opinion that a company is extremely cheap,
yes,
high dividend payer, but that's not necessarily the case. So it's sort of filtering out those that were, you know, genuine recovery plays or undervalued situations, as opposed to those that were, you know, giving you a sort of glimpse of a false dawn as such, if that makes sense.
No, that makes perfect sense. I mean, it's that thing about using the filters to find the stocks, which, whilst they may be at a low PE and having a nice yield, are also safe and lower risk, you know, and have got the catalyst going forward and not detrimental factors that are going to take the business from under your feet, sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, not all things that look golden are, you know, are going to deliver.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And likewise, with potential growth stocks as well.
Yes. Yes. Very much so.
So there are a whole range of things. And I think the beauty for me was that when I look back on what I knew then, you know, I knew very little. And I suspect that in, you know, God willing, in 10 years, you know, I'm probably look back and say, you know, what I know now is far more than, you know, the point of matter at this moment as we speak.
No, that's very, very humble of you. I've read numerous articles that you've written, Martin, and for you to say that, that's great, because the whole premise of this is the fact that everyone, you know, including the fund managers that I've spoken to before, we're all learning, and the whole point is that we're on this journey of discovery, and at some point or other, we'll find a strategy which, if we practice and refine enough, we'll get to a situation where we can consistently make good, sensible decisions, and they may never always turn out profitable, but we can be consistent in what we're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, then. I'm getting the sense here, Martin, that as an investor, you were quite a long-term investor and potentially lower risk in a sense of the stocks that you're picking and the criteria that you're choosing to pick. So would that be about accurate?
Or that's a fair comment. I mean, I'm definitely not a trader.
Yeah.
I don't go in for spread betting or any of that. Each to their own. And, you know, I think that It's what makes this such an interesting field. But for me, yeah, what I like to do, you'll probably be aware, I'm particularly focused at the small cap end.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And I have a sort of quite a leaning towards micro caps. Now, I'm fully aware that, you know, you've got the liquidity issues, the spread, but I think that if you actually do your homework and you get it right on some of these micro caps and stocks, you can do very well. So for me, I like to do the research, get a feel for the company, speak to them if possible. I think that there's two sides to that. I think sometimes you can get too close and, you know, you can't see the wood for the tree.
So yes.
Got to take a step back. But I think it's very beneficial that you speak to the people and get a feel for it. So for me, it'll be taking an initial position and seeing how that goes. And I'm, you know, I'm not averse to buying at a higher price, or if the story's intact and the share price drops for no other reason than people just selling out of pure boredom, as often happens, then I'll pick some more up. So that's my sort of strategy, but I also work on the basis that if a stock moves, if I've got a position and it moves very quickly, nothing goes up in a straight line.
Indeed.
And I'm quite happy to take something off the table as well. And I'll monitor it, you know, sort of on a daily basis, as most people will.
Yeah.
Get the alerts and you know, sort of I try and get a feel for the company. But equally, you have to be sort of detached as well. You know, never fall in love with them.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. I must note that you're in a very, very fortunate position in the sense of you're living in and around Cambridge, and you've got access to the Cambridge Science Park, which has got so many innovative companies there.
Yes.
To be able to go in and speak to some of these CEOs, CFOs, and CTOs, yeah, invariably as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. I've also been very lucky in that my wife works for has done for many years for a company on the Science Park, who were sort of responsible for spinning out companies like Xar, CSR.
Yes, yeah, know it well. Yeah,
Domino Printing.
Yeah,
and it's been very positive for me that I've had the chance to speak to some of these guys that have been involved in these spin-outs.
Yeah.
And, you know, to see what the strategy is, how it plays out. And they don't all succeed.
Of course, no.
You know, there are failures too. But it all adds to, for me, to the sort of armory and basically when you're looking at stocks that may come to the market or that's a fledgling stock, looking to make that transition to real commercialization, I think it just gives you an edge on, you know, how things may pan out or how it's going to pan out. And one of the other things that I find quite useful as well, going along to the places in Cambridge, are the sort of vibes that you get. Again, you know, if you go into some of these workplaces, just to get a feel how the people react, how the place sort of meets you, and, you know? And so the car park, that's something that I've sort of picked up. I went to one Cambridge business, I won't name it, on the car park, appeared to be in difficulty, and although the story appeared from management to be one of a turnaround, looking at the sort of redundancies that have been made and the actual place at the time, I got a feel that it was a company that was in you know, real trouble. That transpired to be the case some years later. So you know, as I say, for me there are a number of things that come into play, and it's not just all about looking at the balance sheet.
I think what you touched on there, though, is it's very important sometimes to get a sense of a company's culture, and what they're about and how they treat the workers and the vision of the actual individuals at the top, and whether they're taking the team with them, you know, and that sometimes can tell you the strength of a company. And I mean, I'm going to touch on the most famous one in the sense of the team behind Arm and when they started as Acorn and how they pushed through and innovated as much as they did to becoming our number one tech company. And the team behind there were phenomenal force, really, for Cambridge. And, you know, hence the reason why Cambridge became the hub that it has been.
Yeah.
Or is, should I say.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, Arm has been an amazing story. And it's interesting because Acorn, for many years, as people will be aware, really struggled.
Yes.
And for Arm to sort of come out of that has been amazing. But, yeah, in Cambridge, I think we've been blessed with a number of successful companies, and there are other businesses following through. Which
yes,
is
that's very good.
Yeah.
That's excellent. So given that you started as a painter and decorator, Martin, and your first foray into stocks was construction, your wife then is involved in tech, science, all the rest of it. Is your portfolio more weighted now towards tech-related stocks?
Yeah, it is, actually.
Yes, I was going to say that.
Okay. Yeah, in fact, you know, over the last, probably the last 7 or 8 years, I've sort of had more of a leaning towards that. And I think that really mirrors the way things progress anyway.
Yes.
Because everything is becoming more and more automated, the new markets are sort of evolving out of technology. So you tend to move with that. And also, I think that, I think we'll all agree that it can be far more exciting reading about some of these technology companies than the likes of Ibstock.
Yes.
and the bricks and the mortar.
Very true.
And I think when people talk about blue sky stocks, it's always the tech sort of leaning companies, isn't it?
Yeah, they do.
But that too can be a bit of a minefield, and you apply the same rules, and in some ways the risks, I think, can be heightened, because many of these companies, they're pre-profitability,
Yes, they are. Yeah.
Or they've just broken into an initial profit, and the forecasts are there to scale up, and that's effectively priced in. So a lot of these companies are on high price earning ratios, and if there's any slip up, if they come out with the slightest whiff of a warning, then they tend to get whacked because they're already trading on a high premium. And I guess that, sorry.
No, as happens, I was about to say, as happens all too frequently with regards to high PE ratio stocks. Yeah.
So people can very quickly get caught out. But getting back to your question, technology, I've got more of a leaning towards that now. I also have a few investment trusts as well.
Okay.
On the other side for income, so I try and get some kind of balance. But I don't in my portfolio, I don't hold any more than 14-15 stocks is my total.
Okay.
I like to keep it around that level.
A nice focus.
Yeah, and with a reasonable split as well.
Okie doke. So with your investment trust, do you diversify a little bit away from the UK? Do you go a bit further afield to give your portfolio a bit of mix?
Yeah. Just prior to the to Brexit, I bought into Middlefield Canadian Trust.
Which
most people probably wouldn't have heard of. And I bought into that because they're focused on North American equities.
Yeah.
And so I guess in some ways it was sort of bit of a hedge. I bought them around about 77, 78. They were yielding. I'm paying a 5p divvy. So they got a good yield on that. And the shares have gone the right way. I think they're currently today are about 98p.
Oh, that's a good call then. Yeah, so, the Brexit call. So, yeah.
But obviously, I bought those for the income.
Yeah, and the long term. Yeah.
Yeah, and I've got a few others. Merchants Trust. Got some of that, and one or two others. So So I think I've got four investment trusts at the moment.
Okay, excellent. So with regards to the lessons that you've learned since the mid-90s when you first started, Martin, what has been the greatest lesson that you've attained since you started investing?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that's a good one, isn't it? Can I give you an example?
Go for it.
I think I've already mentioned about the benefits of going along and meeting management and getting a feel for a business. But I think that going back, probably now we're looking at about 9 years ago, I invested in a company called Screen Technology. I wrote about them. They were based just outside Cambridge. And I went along for a few visits, and they did a few presentations, one in Cambridge, one in London. But I think it was a classic case where I got a little bit too close, believing that the story would come good.
Yeah.
When taking a step back, I would have seen that there were issues, and the company actually went under.
Oh, okay.
So I lost money on that, and it was a big learning curve for me. And I think the red flags were there. Fortunately, it didn't in any way wipe me out, but it taught me a lesson. So I think that for me, I think you have to always retain a level of skepticism, in as much that don't believe everything that's told. Trust your own instinct in as much. If you've got your rules that you set out, and you've got one or two red flags that come up, you need to address that and take stock.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, the interesting thing is, though, Martin, is sometimes the most glaring red flags are the ones we don't see. In a sense of, I've read RNSs, and I'll read, and I think, all right, I've seen enough now. And in the last paragraph, right at the very bottom, before they're saying who the broker is.
Yeah.
That's when they've hidden the news, which you actually need to read.
Sure.
So I've been caught out on that on many occasions. So the red flags are not always obvious. And sometimes the ones that are, we haven't taken the time to read.
Yeah, sure. No, I think you've hit it on the head. And I think that annual reports are good things for reading through. I know it's hard work, but you can find things in there on both sides, good and bad.
Yeah.
I think you're dead right. It's not always that easy, and I think as well that sometimes when you meet a company, it depends on the people that you meet.
It does.
And talk a very good story.
Yes, that's very true.
So I think it's one where you just have to really have your hard rules there and try and stick by them. But we'll never get it right every time.
No, and very large, significant fund managers and institutions have fallen for that as well, and it will continue to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel, for my part, if we can just talk about the writing for a moment.
Yeah.
The writing is a real passion of mine. Obviously, I'm passionate about the investment and long term, I'm looking to make money, as we all are. But as I say, writing is a real passion, and if I can point something out to somebody that they may have not seen, or put something on the map for somebody, I think that's great. Likewise, if I write about something and it then sort of issues bad news, which happened to me with Czar. About 5 years ago, I went along for a visit, penned a piece, and a month later, they issued a profit warning. And you take that to heart in a way, because you're writing this stuff, and you want to convey a good story, that you yourself believe in, and in no way do I want to be sort of singled out as somebody trying to pump or dump something. There's people
who do.
But you're always wary of that, and you sort of put yourself on the line a little bit. But I hope that I get it right more times than not.
No, clearly. I mean, 16 years on now, writing for the Cambridge News site, it's clear that you've always remained impartial in the sense of these are the companies out there, and this is the quality of the stock as I've seen it today.
Yeah.
You know, and potential is here, and here are the caveats and risks. And invariably, sometimes even the CEOs and CFOs don't know what's coming. You know, sure. I mean, and today, case in point, the FCA have decided to go all in regarding spread betting and CFDs. So right. IG, CMC, plus 500 have been hammered by the tune of 20 to 40% at some stage this morning.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, for all of the institutions that are in that stock, could have seen the FCA are going to be troubling and going after these companies because they don't get any revenues from CFDs and other binary bets. That at some point the government was going to come after them, the FCA was going to come after them, but they didn't. So some large institutions and pension funds have been hit hard today, you know, by that happening.
Sure.
So you just can't, you know, no one can foretell. And anyone that tells you they can forecast what's going to happen the next 3 minutes in the stock market, you know, they need to be doing something else for the job,
yeah,
really.
I think you're right, Peter. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. So what has been your wisest investment decision to date, Martin?
Right. In terms of, you're talking about monetary success?
It could be monetary or personal. I mean, other than, you know, meeting your wife, you know.
that was the greatest one.
Yes, right? You better say that because she's going to listen to this.
She's not here at the moment. well, in terms of money, it was Blinks.
Right, okay.
I don't hold the stock now and I probably wouldn't again. But at the time, I bought in, I covered it in the news. I spoke with somebody at the time because I had an operation in Cambridge.
Oh, okay.
And I just felt at the price at the time, it was about 13p.
Right.
I just felt it was worth a speculative punt.
Mm-hmm.
And I you know, sort of outlined that in the article. Now, I'd had a good couple of years, and I, you know, sort of singled out some money on the side that, you know, I was happy to have a speculative punt on something like that, which I did. And they subsequently moved up to about 17p, and they then issued some very upbeat news, and the stock started to move further north.
Yeah,
I bought more at 20 pence. I then sold out at three points, 80, about 82p.
Brilliant.
£1.28, I think, and just under the top. They did hit 160, and I took everything out at about £1.40. And the reason being was that. It was, you know, on a sky high valuation.
Yeah. So you scaled in, and then you also scaled out, which is quite sensible. Yeah.
That's right. And from there on, they were all over the place, as I'm sure many listeners.
Yeah. Lots of different news, autonomy issues, and all the rest of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So in terms of returns, that was very very substantial. But I've had some really nice touches on stocks that I've held for some time, and you know, I still hold some of those now. In terms of a sort of time scale, I'm happy to hold something for years, but invariably, I think, you know, if you double your money, and you know, the valuation looks high, and there's something else that attracts your interest, then I'll be happy to move on.
Yeah. You've answered my next question there. I was going to ask about your time scales in a sense of how long you keep certain stocks and when do you then look to de-risk or top slice or scale out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if I give you a case in point, I'm holding a company at the moment that I've been covering now for about 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
a company based in Cambridge, Scientific Digital Imaging.
Yes. Yep.
And I'd been tracking them since about 2012 when I penned my first piece on them, but I didn't invest at the time. And I made my first investment in SDI, which was will be about two years in January.
Okay.
And they issued their released their interim results, and it was a classic case where they looked awful, but if you read between the lines, it wasn't as bad as what the market sort of marked it down to. So I took an initial stake at, I think it was about 8.5p, 8.75p.
Yeah.
And I added again just over 9. I've added on two further occasions. And the story, for my part, is evolving quite nicely. The shares are currently about 17.5p.
Excellent.
But I haven't looked to exit because I think that there's more to come there.
Mm-hmm.
And I say this to, you know, people who are listening. I'm not saying that to, you know, sort of try and pump it up, but I just think it's a classic case of a business that was poorly run, wasn't really going anywhere, to one that has been sort of restructured and has is delivering on its early remit of acquiring businesses, and they're sort of pursuing a similar model to Judges Scientific, which to a big success story. So, you know, I'm probably going sort of round Will's mother's here, but it's for me something like that. I took my first stake 2 years back. I'm still in there, and I'm hoping that the story will continue to go the right way. It may not. There may be some bad news come out, you know, as often happens.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping that they'll continue to grow and acquire more businesses, and also increase, you know, organically as well.
One of the things I find with tech stocks is that it takes, some of them come too early to the market almost.
Yeah.
And obviously they raise their funds and all the rest of it, but then there's an expectation that they will then deliver within the next 18 months, and some of them don't, and then they drift because the catalyst hasn't arrived.
Yeah.
And then people then lose faith in them, and that's the very moment when things are finally being crystallized, and then the market becomes unaware, and the story starts to grow, and the momentum of the products that they wanted to actually deliver 2 years prior finally arrives.
Yes.
And that's when the stocks, you used to think, what was that stock again? And then suddenly it becomes back in the news, and it's already doubled in the price, tripled in the price. And then I've been in the same position thinking, right, okay, I've missed the boat now. So therefore I can't be going to buy that now because I've left it too late.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I sort of agree with that. Absolutely. And you see it time and again.
Yeah.
You know, I've had companies that I've looked at and even spoken with companies and written a piece. Because, you know, not everything, everything that I write about, I don't buy.
Yeah.
I try and make a case out for it. But there have been some that, you know, look to have a good story. I've written about them. And they've gone off of the radar because things just haven't progressed. And then all of a sudden, you'll realize that there's been this catalyst, and they're sort of building momentum, and the shares have gone, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Just leaves you behind, leaves us trailing, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, always frustrating that is. Now, Martin, I know, you know, yes, you're a private investor. Yes, you write for the Cambridge News, but you also have another role at Cambridge College. What is it you do
right.
there?
Okay, right. Well, in terms of the college, it's related to my old business. So what happened, I worked for myself, so I employed subcontractors and had somebody with me as well, you know, all the time. And I used to undertake a lot of work for Cambridge colleges, you know, Homerton College, Corpus Christi College, and one or two others to a lesser degree. And what happened to me was I was increasing my activity on the share front and the writing. So I became disillusioned with the decorating side of the business. A, as you're getting older, it becomes harder to do that sort of stuff.
The knees, the joints, the neck, the back.
And I was sort of approaching my late 40s. And also, one of the problems with the construction industry is that if you employ subcontract labour, for example, if I employed you, Peter, for 2 months, and then I let you go, I didn't have sufficient work for you for a couple of months, the Inland Revenue basically sees it that you're still working for me. So what you have to do, you're inundated with forms that you have to keep sending back.
Right, okay.
Say, well, actually, Peter isn't working for me. I'm not stopping him any tax, and I'm not sending it in. And there was so much red tape associated with the construction industry that, you know, it, with all my other interests, you know, the writing and the investing side, I just sort of felt that, you know, this was becoming a bit too much. So at the time, I was doing a large contract for Corpus Christi College, and the chap who was the clerk of the works informed me that after that they were going to be upping their own team. Basically, the strategy of the bursar at the time was to bring it more in house. So I just happened to come out and say, "Well, you know, have you got a job for me then?" And I think the guy thought I was joking, but I wasn't. So what I do now, I spend 3 days a week at Corpus Christi College, and I do very much, although it's not quite as strenuous as working for yourself, but that's what I do. I do decorating on the old buildings in the college, which is quite a nice contrast, actually. I enjoy the writing and sitting in front of a screen. As I said earlier, it can become all encompassing.
It's nice to get away from it all. I use mindfulness and I do a fair bit of meditation and get away from the screen. Not as much as I should do, but that's how I do it. And so definitely that's a good thing to have.
Yeah. The other thing I would just add into there, it was quite beneficial for me as well, because I had a SIP that I was running, but obviously the university, when I joined, they closed it now, but they still operated a final salary pension scheme.
Yeah.
So I decided to transfer my SIP into that to buy extra years.
Okay.
In the final salary pension scheme, which it's got its drawbacks in that I've got to hang on for a few more years.
Yes.
I get on my bike on a sort of Wednesday and Thursday and Friday, and I bike into the college and I bike.
Excellent.
Yeah.
That's really good.
So that's sort of where I'm at, and as I say, it works well for me.
Mm. Have you found, Martin, over the years, since you've been doing this 3 days a week at Corpus Christi, that your conversations are now being more focused on stocks, and you're encouraging all these other painter and decorators and labourers to invest for the long term? Have you been coaching, mentoring them, you know, almost subliminously?
Yeah, well, I would like to say that was the case, but a lot of these guys, this is one of the things that I'm quite passionate about. A lot of these guys, they are interested, but they won't make the move.
Oh, I see.
In as much that they're unsure, and I've tried to steer a couple of the guys into some of the. You know, some of the material. I mean, one chap I recommended a book that I read years ago, How to Read the Financial Pages by Mike.
Great book. Yeah.
And one of the guys borrowed that and had a look through. But I think there's still, for many people, there's still this sort of mystique about the market. And people, you know, they hear the headlines, you know, the FTSE has crashed by, you know, X amount, so many billions. And, you know, people are frightened of that. And they're frightened to take that leap, I think. And for many people, it's a no-go area, which is wrong for me, because you know, people are quite happy to put money into a private pension that is run by other people,
yeah,
looking after your money. But one of the sort of early things for me was that, you know, I like to look after my own money.
Indeed, I do as well. Yeah,
best way to do that. So, but each to their own, and. You know, for me, when I'm with the guys at the college, you know, it's the usual sort of talk that you'll get on any construction site.
Yeah,
it's sports, you know, a little bit of politics maybe.
Yeah,
and a lot of stuff like, yeah, I'm a celebrity, get me out of here, which, yeah, I don't sort of
just banter, have some banter. Yes, yeah.
Oh,
brilliant. Now, I always find this quite an interesting question. If there's one thing you could change, Martin, regarding the investing landscape, what would it be?
Ooh, that's a difficult one. Well, I don't know how this will go down with listeners, but I have strong feelings about short selling.
Yep.
And I accept that it has a place. But I just feel that it is open to massive manipulation, which I think has been proven before. Now, I accept that, you know, if there's something untoward, you know, people short a stock and they're vindicated, as I think if we point to something like Glovo,
Paul
Scott wrote some excellent stuff on that, and I can certainly, you know, sort of go along with those sort of views. But I think, likewise, on the other foot, stocks can be driven down for no other reason than people have that opportunity to do it.
Yeah,
and I think, you know, I feel quite strongly that you can have people holding shares in nominee accounts that, you know, can be used actually against their own interests.
No, it makes perfect sense, and it does frustrate me when you've got custodians, large cap, you know, major custodians, global ones as well, who. Yeah. Have those stocks held on nominee, and you see them loaning them out. I'm like, how very dare you?
Yeah.
You know, why do you need that extra couple of £1,000 or whatever it is that you're making on doing that arbitrary when it belongs to somebody else? So it really, really does frustrate me that. Yeah, so I agree with you wholeheartedly on that front. Yeah.
So I'm not advocating that it should be abolished, but I just, it's something that I would certainly like to see looked at. You know, I feel quite strongly about that one.
I'm glad you shared that with us.
Again, though, you know, each to their own, and you know, I'm just sort of throwing out my own thoughts on that one. And you know, you sort of sit either side of the fence on it, really, don't you?
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, there's a whole point about sharing ideas on this podcast. So that's great. Thanks for sharing that. Right. Given the many lessons that you've learned since you started investing, Martin, other than what you've already shared with me, which one would you most like to share with our global audience of the many lessons?
Again, that's a really, really difficult one. I think for me, I'm just going to have to go back onto what I said earlier. I think is to stand by your own conviction and what you believe.
Okay.
So, you know, I think that too often we can be swayed by what you read and what other people say. And I, you know, I think that if you have your own strategy and your own sort of beliefs and your own sort of key points that you follow, you should stick with that and, you know, not be swayed by, you know, too many outside influences.
Yeah.
That is a, for me, it's a big thing. I mean, a classic case in point is, you know, when the market dives, you know, people panic and will exit the stock for no other reason than the fact that, you know, the market's down, and take a loss because, you know, the herd is saying this is what you should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you actually take a step back, I know it's not always easy, but if you take a step back and look at the company in question and say, well, what's actually changed for the business and the fundamentals of that, you stick with it. I don't know whether that's the sort of answer you're looking for. But,
no, yeah. that's a perfect answer. That's a good answer. I mean, the thing that I find is that, and to reiterate what you said, is the importance of research. And once you get to a time, having done what you've done now for, you know, since the mid-90s, Martin, and doing a dummy run for a few years, is that you're refining and learning all the time. So you've now got your strategy. Martin has got his strategy. And the whole point of what you're doing at Cambridge News and what I'm doing and other people are doing is the fact that we're enabling and helping other people to find their own strategy. We're not saying ours is the best strategy. We're saying just keep learning and enable yourself to be comfortable with your own piece of research and then do what you need to do when you want to do it, not when anyone else dictates that it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. I think you've hit it on the head there. I think that, you know, the beauty about having so much information out there is that you can use that and you can apply it to your own strategy. And that's why, you know, I think this sense of constant learning comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I read lots of other people's, you know, stuff. I like what Paul Scott writes. You might not agree with everything that he puts in there, but I think he does a great job. I look at the Investors Chronicle, certain people in the FT, and I think you can use all those aspects and bring it together to formulate your own sort of strategy.
Yeah.
And I don't know about other people. I don't know about you either, Peter. But for me, I tend to look at a piece of news a company releases, and you pull all those other aspects, what you're looking for, together.
Yeah.
So you can actually get a quick feel. Everything sort of kicks into play. So as opposed to, you know, I don't tend to, you know, sort of go through, I'm sort of, a lot of people follow graphs and
mm-hmm.
you know, all that sort of thing, which I don't.
Right.
What I'm trying to say is that I use all the other sort of tools and aspects, and they just sort of come together. And
yeah.
I get an initial picture from that.
I mean, you use more fundamental analysis and macro, and the sense of you're in the construction industry, you're speaking with people, you're seeing things moving around all the while.
Yeah.
You've got the exposure to the science park and all the rest of it. But I will try and use all of that and lots of other research. But every now and then, and you'll see some of the tweets that I put out with charts on, I like to know where the moving average is. I like to know that the volume has increased.
Sure.
You know, because sometimes I'm looking and thinking, right, okay, crikey, today's volume on that particular stock is three times above the 30-day average. So I'm thinking, could there be some news there? Or does that mean that a fund is interested in the stock because the volume is up, the price has gone up? If the volume's gone up and the price has gone down, is someone exiting the stock?
Yeah.
So I do try and look at some of those things. And
I agree.
As
Sorry.
Well as, on top
Coming
of all
in there.
Those
yeah.
things. Yeah.
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 I'm not saying, it doesn't feature at all. It does. And I'll give you another case in point. I hold a stock called Future.
Yes. Yeah. Marketing company. Yeah.
Yeah. They're behind magazines like TechRadar. I won't go into the story, but they've been sort of through a big transition process. And the volume really kicked up last week, following their results. And that's sort of following into what you've just said, because the shares have actually responded, and I think there was maybe a seller that was sitting there that's been cleared out.
Yeah.
So yeah, absolutely, it has an important role. But for me, it's not one that I think what I'm trying to say is features greatly as much as some of the other stuff on the sort of fundamental.
Oh, absolutely. I think the criteria we all have got to be important to us, in a sense of, I never look at a stock firstly from a chart. It's got to be the fundamentals. It's got to be the balance sheet, just similar to yourself, Martin. And the important thing for me also at times is I very rarely get to meet the CEOs and CFOs, which you're fortunate to do. But I also look at their back history and where they've been, what they've done, and how did they treat the company that they were previously at. And sometimes I will purchase a stock purely on the fact that that fund manager and that CEO, CFO did something at this company.
Yeah,
and that's the reason why I went in. And I think Didora of Sky Pharma, when he came into Sky Pharma, I was like, right, I'm having some of that. And it was completely off the radar. I think it was something like 40-odd pence at the time. Yeah. And I went into that stock and everyone was like, Peter, what's your interest in there? I said, look, check this guy out. Look what he's done and what his plans are. Yeah. And as we know, Sky Pharma was loss-making. It was, it was on its knees almost. And he transformed the company, and it ended up being taken over for £4 odd by Vectura in the end.
Yes.
And the great thing about it is that he's also been taken to Vectura to get their finances in order up there. So I've followed that up and gone into I've had Vectura before that anyway, but I've left a little bit of my Sky Pharma money go into Vectura, so I've almost doubled up my holdings in that. So you've got to do your research. It goes back down to what you said at the very beginning, Martin. People have to do research.
Yeah, that's a great example. It's a really good point, that one. And if I can just add one in on a similar line.
Go for it.
I was taking a look at a company formerly known as Belgravium that's now Touchstar.
Right, okay.
And I bought into that on the basis that a new guy came in as chairman, and that was a guy called Ian Martin, who had been instrumental in turning around Abesco. And he got a really good track record. And I spoke to him soon after he stepped into the role at Belgravium, now Touchstar. And he outlined exactly what he wanted to do with the company, where he saw it going. And thus far, he's really delivered on that. And I bought in an initial stake, basically, like you've just highlighted, on Pharma, on his track record and what I, felt that he could do for the company. And so far, it seems to be moving in the right direction.
That's excellent, because Belgravium had been around for a long, long time, always promising, hadn't they?
Underperformed, looked like there was lack of investment or lack of innovation. And I think Ian Martin sort of picked it up by the scruff of the neck.
Yes.
Better word.
Yeah.
And I think it's got a bit of a future. Hopefully.
Excellent. Now, Marty, I've kept you for a little while. I've got two more questions I wanted to ask you.
Yeah.
The first one was, if you were starting out today in investing, what would you do that you had not considered or you were unable to do back in the mid-90s?
Right. Okay. I would certainly have invested more at an earlier point. So by that, what I mean is that when I first started investing, we were fortunate in that we renovated our home and I had some money left over, which, I used. But I could probably have invested more than I had. And I was probably overly cautious in those earlier days, specifically in terms of dividend paying stocks. So I would probably have gone in and invested a fair bit more than what I did. Because I think that in my early days, you were always sort of cautious in terms of timelines. By that, what I mean in terms of news flow on the economy.
Yeah.
If one thing that time has taught me is that, we see a recession, it comes, it goes. We see a downturn and it eventually goes the other way. But when you're in the thick of it, you can be sort of constrained by short-termism. Does that make sense?
Of course. I mean, it might sound like a strange rhetorical, but if we get blinded by the noise, there's so much noise out there regarding, when classic was Brexit, the world's going to implode if the EU referendum goes a certain way. And the very large and significant fund managers all bailed out on the morning of that decision and decided that's it, they've got to get out of the market, this is the world's going to end. And then the market went, you know what, let's just see and let's just take our time. And within 3 or 4 days, the market decided to factor certain things in, and it's far higher than it was now. And for instance, going back to where you started in the sense of construction and building companies, I started to buy the builders that week or the couple of weeks after, and I started to build a little mini buy-to-let portfolio for myself with the likes of Persimmon and Galliford Try and Hallam Mask and a few others. And I thought, right, okay, if the fund managers are throwing them away and the yielding 11%, some of these builders were, and I thought, well, they're not gonna be able to go down to Chelsea or the best part of Kensington and pick up that £4 million house now for £2.5 million. So instead, I'll buy Persimmon if they're going to give it away.
So
we just have to learn to ignore the noise sometimes, but it is difficult, I must admit. Okay, so my last question to you, Martin, thanks for coming on here and sharing all your insights. It's very much appreciated. Is some books, if you were to say to, somebody who's new to investing, I've read this book and I would recommend this book. If you could just give us two for the novice investor and also the experienced investor, which two books would you share with us, please?
Right. The first one would be the one that I've already mentioned, the How to Read the Financial Pages, which has been updated by Michael Brett, because I think there's just so much in that. Have you read that at all?
I have read it, yes. At the time when I read it, I found it quite difficult. But I think I wasn't open to it. I think for me sometimes with the book, I need to get a sense of the author. And if the person is trying to be too technical, I drift off.
Yes.
But as I've got older, I find the more I drift off, the more I take in. I think it's about the fact I'm a bit more patient now with what I read. And I have to go back and read it sometimes twice or three times. I think, aha, I get that now. Yeah. But I read that too early, I think. I wanted to be able to do it too quickly, and I didn't take it all in at the time.
Yeah, sure.
Great book.
Yeah, I think the thing about that particular book is that you can move around within it, and you can home in on a specific area and you can go back to it. And I think the updated versions are actually easier than the earlier.
The original one. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, excellent.
And the other one, and I can't think of the title now, it's a Jim Slater book.
Okay.
That for me, I read that going back probably about 10 years ago, and I'm trying to think of the title, but it's all about his strategies, but also background on how he achieved what he achieved and what his strategies were.
I mean, he's written a few. You've obviously got the Zulu Principle.
Yeah, it's not the Zulu Principle.
Investment Made Easy, maybe?
Yeah, I think that could be it, actually. Yeah, I think that could be it. But alongside that, the other book that I read going back some years, that was The Company Refs.
Oh, I used to read that in the library, Martin. That's when I first started doing my proper research. I used to go into the library after work or whatever I could get my hands on. Yes, brilliant. Yeah.
I mean, I use that in conjunction with Hem Scott, which is now Morning Star.
Yes, yeah.
And in the days when I first started doing most of my reading, the Hem Scott wasn't online. It was all just in a big book form, rather like the company refs.
Yeah.
I used to use those in conjunction with each other, and they were updated regularly, quarterly. And it was great because you could trawl through and you could, you know, you could look on at a company, look at the balance sheet.
Yeah.
And it was a great starting point. Of course, it's now so much easier.
It is so much easier. I mean, what I used to love about the company refs was when you thought you found a really nice stock, and it projected what the growth was on the tiny little graphs you used to have the top right hand corner.
Yeah.
And it said, oh, you know what, if they do hit these targets, potentially the share price could be here. And if the arrow was on the top right-hand corner, you're like, oh, I found a nice one here.
Yeah.
Didn't always work out, but it was nice to see that projected sort of growth.
Yeah. But it does give a glimpse of, you know, the potential, doesn't it?
Yes, yes.
And, you know, I mean, I remember going to a presentation of Cambridge Silicon Radio before they floated. A couple of years before they floated, when it was spun out of Cambridge Consultants, there was a team of about six people, and they were presenting to investors. These were your institution investors. This was ahead of before they floated.
Yeah,
and they had a projection of where their markets, you know, were and where they projected it to go to and what they believed they would achieve. And I was with a mate, and he said, oh, it just looks far too ambitious to me. He said, I can't see that. I mean, appliances talking to each other and all this sort of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm going back a few years now, but it came to fruition. And my point is that, you know, a lot of the numbers that were bandied around at the time, you know, people said, I can't see they'll ever achieve that.
And they're being exceeded because we know the growth of Internet of Things is going to be fast, you know, fast outweigh everything else, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okie doke. Now, Martin, I've covered all my questions. Thank you ever so much. I just wanted to know if there's one thing you wanted to encapsulate this interview with in order to share to our listeners, just to say, you know, if there's one thing I'm going to say to all of you is this, what would it be?
The one thing I would say is, if you want to repeat myself, stick by your own principles and what you believe in. But alongside that, keep an open mind and read as much as you can from different sources. Keep an open mind. And you can, you know, sort of filter all that through. And then at the end of the day, you know, I think you make your own decision and you sort of stick by that. But I think there's a wealth of information out there. And this sort of thing that you're doing, I think, is great. I've listened to your earlier stuff and, the one that you conducted with Gervais Williams of Mighton.
Okay.
I thought that was super. Nicola Duke, I think, I found that very interesting. And some of the others as well.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you.
I can't conjure them all up at the moment, but
there's a few there now. Yes, it's getting there. I'm hoping to do a few more interesting ones in 2017 and a few more PIs like yourself. So, yeah, that's great. Thank you very much. Okay. All right, then, Martin. Thank you ever so much. That was Martin Flitton, who's on Twitter as Private Punter. You can also find Martin's articles on the Cambridge News website and also the Cambridge Business Weekly magazine. Martin, I look forward to working with you in the future. Hopefully we can do something and maybe pay a visit down to Suffolk, Norfolk, Cambridge sides to do something with Share Talk, hopefully at some point.
Yeah, no, super. No, that's great. Well, thanks again for the time, and I've enjoyed it. It's
excellent.
Good.
No, that's really, really good. That's really kind of you. I look forward to speaking to you again soon, Martin. Thank you ever so much.
Yeah, cheers.
Okay, mate. Bye for now.
Bye.
Cheers, chap. Bye.